Good afternoon. I'd like to call this meeting the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee to order at 1:34 p.m. We're in Belts Room 105 of the Thomas Stewart Building. Today is Friday, the Ides of March 15th, 2024. Members present are Senator Merrick, Senator Dunbar, Senator Gray Jackson, Senator Bishop, and myself, Senator Bjorkman. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Please turn off or silence your cell phones. I would like to recognize and welcome our recording secretary, Mary Gwen Kawakami, and our LIO moderator, Joseph Giesbrecht. Welcome, everyone, to Senate Labor and Commerce. We have three items on our agenda today. First up is Senate Bill 44, Naturopaths, Licensing, and Practice. Then we'll take up Senate Bill 225, Occupational Licensing Fees, and Senate Bill 237, Tax Credit, Child Care, Utility, House, Food. First up, Senate Bill 44. This bill has been previously scheduled, but those hearings have been unfortunately canceled. So this will be our first hearing on Senate Bill 44. To present the bill, we have the sponsor, Honorable Senator Kathy Giesel, and her staff, Jane Conway. Senator, welcome to Labor and Commerce.
Thank you, Senator Bjorkman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for hearing this bill and members of the committee also. For the record, I'm Kathy Giesel. I have the honor of serving Senate District E. That encompasses part of the municipality of Anchorage down to Whittier. Mr. Chairman, I want to tell you why I am offering Senate Bill 44. That's always the question. Why are we doing this? Mr. Chairman, I am an advanced nurse practitioner. My national board certification is in family practice. I received my master's degree from the University of Alaska, Anchorage. It was a wonderful education through the university, not only in conventional medicine, but the faculty had a visionary approach in that they also included naturopathic type alternative medicine in our graduate program. In fact, my master's thesis was on the use of alternative medicines by mothers of children less than 3 years old. So it was a qualitative study, but that was my master's thesis. After graduation at the turn of the century, which sounds like a really long time ago, but that was the year 2000, I actually began to work in an alternative medicine clinic. And in that venue, I worked with a medical doctor, a physician, a couple other nurse practitioners, and several naturopaths, naturopathic doctors. And I learned so much from those naturopathic doctors. I had never worked with them before. I had never sought care from a naturopath. But I learned so much working with them and seeing how they approached healthcare from a very broad picture of the client that they were serving, and carefully looking at the root cause of whatever the patient's complaint was. They of course could not prescribe, and so they often came to me with the case of the patient that they were working with and would ask me to write the prescription for typically thyroid supplement or other typically was hormone replacement, natural hormone replacement. I found them to be very conservative, limited use of prescriptive medications, understanding the multiple side effects that pharmaceuticals have. And so they really did try to take a very careful approach to patients. Many of them were educated at Bastyr University. This is in Washington State. And so because of the abundant information I learned from naturopaths, I actually took some courses through Bastyr and, again, learned so much. These folks are sought after by Alaskans. They get to the root cause. They have a very gentle approach to medical care, very conservative. In fact, you know, they're everywhere. This is a copy of the Senior Voice, which you guys are all so young. You probably don't read the Senior Voice, but Emily Kane is a naturopath who regularly writes in the Senior Voice. I mean, this article is Treat Your Stomach Right and It Will Treat You Right. And she's talking about just common sense things. But this is how a naturopath approaches healthcare. They do occasionally need a prescriptive medication, but they're not the first thing they turn to. So I just wanted to give you that background, Mr. Chairman. I'm not coming at this randomly. Yes, it was by request that I offer the bill, but I can personally attest that these are credible healthcare providers. So with that, Mr. Chairman, not to take up too much time, I will turn it over to, if it's your pleasure, turn it over to my staff, Jane Conway, who can do a brief overview of the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Giesel. Ms. Conway.
Good afternoon on the Ides of March, Chairman Bjorkman and the members of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. My name is Jane Conway. For the record, I work for Senator Kathy Giesel. We have just a few slides taking kind of a really high-level look at the bill. So what is a naturopathic doctor? A naturopathic doctor is a primary care provider with a four-year postgraduate degree, medical degree, and they practice evidence-based primary care with a patient-centered focus. They prioritize disease prevention and discovering root causes of illness. Those treatments focus on lifestyle modifications, nutrition, diet alterations, low-risk intervention, exercise, stress management, lifestyle changes, always in search of the why. Why is my body doing this? Why do I feel like this? Where's the cause of it? You did get a new letter submitted to you this week by the Federation of Naturopathic Regulatory Authorities. I don't know if you've had time to read it, but it had a lot of information in it. And it did say that according to HRSA, H-R-S-A, I can't remember what HRSA means, but anyway, they are predicting that in the next decade, we will need 237 primary care doctors. Well, we have about between 48 and 50 naturopathic doctors here in Alaska, and with the passage of this bill, we would they would be ready to go as full-fledged primary care doctors in Alaska. And the Institute of Medicine, according to that same document, encourages use of interdisciplinary teams to optimize patient care. Naturopathic doctors fit nicely into that model. So what about their education? They require a four-year medical school program accredited by the Council of Naturopathic Medical Education with 2 years of medical sciences, including anatomy, physiology, microbiology, immunology, etc. The prerequisite for that is a four-year undergraduate degree and additional pre-med coursework. Residency is less common for naturopaths because they are not trained as hospitalists. There are some residency options available in the United States for naturopathic doctors, but there is a real shortage of those opportunities for them. Residencies are not required for independent primary care providers who hold prescriptive privileges, such as APRNs and PAs. Naturopaths must pass the two-part naturopathic physician's licensing examination, the NCLEX, before being licensed to practice. And we have an expert today online to testify, Dr. Kerry Baldwin, who is an authority on naturopathic doctor education. So education questions would be really direct to her. She would have very good answers for you. There's often a lot of misconceptions about who a naturopathic doctor is, like who are they? It's not somebody who sells doTERRA essential oils. It's not somebody who works in a healthcare store. Or took an online course. They're not massage therapists or any other unlicensed providers that promote themselves as natural care providers. They are not MDs. They are not DOs. They're not chiropractors, nor nurse practitioners, PAs, or massage therapists. So I have three maps coming up here just to give you a little bit of scope of what's going on in the United States regarding the profession of naturopathy. This is the licensing map. So you can see there's 24 states that regulate naturopaths. You can see that Alaska is one of them. In 10 other states, the pink ones, there's active licensure initiatives going on in those states. Advocacy is happening in Texas and Wyoming. Some of the orange states, more at a grassroots level, but there is growing interest in the practice of naturopathy. And then this map is about those states who have a prescriptive authority for naturopaths. And you can see we do not. We are a gold state, however. That's why we are up. It's part of Senate Bill 44. 12 states, there is prescriptive authority in some form. And one state, California, there is prescriptive authority with a sidebar or two. So we have Dr. Clyde Jensen today on the line, and he teaches pharmacology classes to both naturopathic doctors and medical doctors. And his testimony will be quite informative. And then this last map is scope of practice by state and which states authorize naturopaths to prescribe controlled substances. And you will see that there's not many that do. Senate Bill 44 is not asking for prescriptive authority for controlled substances. But there are six states that do, and others coming on. So in wrap up, Senate Bill 44 modernizes statutes for naturopaths, and it cleans up some very outdated and antiquated language that's currently in the statutes. it imposes the same public health duties on naturopaths as other medical providers. Updates scope of practice for naturopaths that includes limited prescriptive authority. And that is an important aspect of this bill. Because oftentimes when the naturopath is seeing a patient and they've exhausted all their typical remedies, they may need to prescribe perhaps an antibiotic or a high blood pressure medicine when it is necessary, which is usually a last resort. And what does that mean? That means then, currently, that same patient then must go find a primary care doctor, get an appointment, go see them in order to get this very basic prescription. And that is inconvenient and costly for the patient, and it also drives up insurance costs because now you have to have two visits for a very basic care. This bill also allows minor office procedures, something like some stitches, something like wart removal. They are trained in IUD placement and removal, and there's various other minor office procedures that currently they are not allowed to do. So Senate Bill 44 would end duplicative office visits, improve the care for Alaskans, and provide more choice for patients. And, you know, more and more people are looking for alternative ways to approach their health. There's more demand for naturopaths. They want to know, as I stated earlier, the whys of how they feel a certain way. And they're looking to do that in a way that doesn't necessarily need to have a prescription. And with that, I am completed with this presentation. And we have some very interesting and educated testifiers waiting to speak on Senate Bill 44, if that is your desire. Chairman Bjorkman.
Thank you, Mia. Are there any questions for the bill sponsor or staff? Senator Bishop.
Senator Geisel, I thought I heard you say earlier that you served in a clinic that had a naturopath and a regular doctor. Is that right? Is that a one-off, or is it common? You know what I mean? Or you know what I'm trying to say is...
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bishop, yes, it was an integrative healthcare facility. So it integrates allopathic, so the conventional medicine, with alternative medicine. The title of the clinic was alternative medicine. To add to that, Mr. Chairman, Senator Bishop, I actually haven't been to a full physician type practice in quite a few years. The clinic that I see is a nurse practitioner with naturopath clinic, owned by nurse practitioners employing naturopaths.
Follow up?
Yep.
Can you just give me a sense, or I know you can answer my question. Can you give me an example of limited prescriptive authority?
Well, I mentioned earlier, Mr. Chairman, Senator Bishop, that in my practice, working with a naturopath, they would often need to prescribe thyroid supplement. This is common. Women after 40 very, very commonly have decreased thyroid function, causing fatigue, lots of other symptoms. But that is just so common, and so that was a common prescription. Also hormone replacement, occasionally an antibiotic, but that was a last resort, which was very appropriate. We have a lot of resistant bacteria now because of overuse of antibiotics, but those were the main prescriptions that I would write for naturopath.
Last follow up on this topic.
Yes.
So, a naturopath, would I assume, couldn't write a schedule schedule class 3 prescription?
Yes, you're asking about the scheduled medications, the controlled substances. Yes. So controlled substance prescribing is very limited, even for conventional healthcare providers. I have to have a DEA, a Drug Enforcement Administration, authorization to prescribe controlled substances, which I have. And there are 5 categories of controlled substances. I can certainly give you a handout that describes what each one is. But it's basically things like oxycodone, sleeping pills such as Soma. These are controlled substances. They're commonly addictive, and so that's why they're controlled.
Thank you.
This is not asked for, by the way, in this bill for initiatives.
Put on the record.
Thank you.
Very good. Well, first up, first invited testifier in the room, we have Dr. Timothy Birdsall.
Good afternoon, Chairman Bjorkman and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today in support of Senate Bill 44. My name is Dr. Tim Birdsall. I'm a licensed naturopathic doctor in the state of Alaska. I practice at Avante Medical Center in Anchorage. In addition to my Alaska license, I also hold naturopathic licenses in the states of Washington, Arizona, and California. I've practiced primary care in outpatient clinics, in multidisciplinary settings, where I worked alongside MDs, DOs, physician assistants, nurse practitioners. And I've also spent over 2 decades in hospital-based outpatient and inpatient care. Naturopathic doctors have been licensed in at least some jurisdictions in the United States for over 100 years, and in here in Alaska for over 35 years. Naturopathic doctors are well-trained, as you've already heard described. We have an undergraduate pre-medicine degree requirement and then 4 years of naturopathic medical school. And the first 2 years of this training include standard medical sciences, anatomy, physiology, biochemistry, microbiology, pathology, pharmacology, those types of topics. And the last 2 years cover the clinical sciences, looking at things like cardiology, gastroenterology, pediatrics, gynecology. And it also includes over 1,200 hours of supervised clinical training that takes place with naturopathic students being overseen by licensed naturopathic doctors as well as by licensed MDs and DOs. Naturopathic medical schools are subject to the same kind of accreditation and oversight as other medical training programs and other universities. Senator Giesel mentioned Bastyr University in Seattle, which happens to be my alma mater. But Bastyr University and the National University of Health Sciences in Portland, Oregon, are the two oldest naturopathic medical schools in the U.S., And as an example, they're both accredited by the Northwest Commission on Colleges and Universities. That's the same accrediting agency that provides accreditation oversight for the University of Alaska. And then in addition, the naturopathic program at these schools is also accredited by the Council on Naturopathic Medical Education, which is recognized as a programmatic accreditor by the U.S. Department of Education. So there's an immense amount of educational oversight in terms of these programs. Graduation from a naturopathic medical school then is followed by taking the National Board exam, which has already been mentioned, the NCLEX exam, that includes an examination in pharmacology. This required education and training of naturopathic doctors compares very favorably to that of nurse practitioners, who have even broader prescriptive authority than we're asking for here in Senate Bill 44, and have had that authority in Alaska for 40 years. They've demonstrated themselves to be safe and effective primary care providers with that level of training. Senate Bill 44 authorizes naturopathic doctors in the state of Alaska to practice to the extent of our education, our training, and our experience. This education and training includes the use of prescriptive medications and minor office procedures when they're appropriate. And I think that's an important point to emphasize. I will give you a couple of examples, but I probably would prescribe medication to my patients in Alaska somewhere less than 10% of the time, perhaps 5% of the time, when it's appropriate. In the other three states where I hold a license, naturopathic doctors are authorized to prescribe those drugs when they're necessary. And naturopathic doctors in these states, even with the broadest prescriptive authority, have been practicing safely within that scope of practice for decades. I recently saw a patient in my practice just last week, came in complaining of a sore throat. We did an in-office test, and it was positive for a streptococcal infection. She had strep throat. She needed to be on an antibiotic. But because of the limitations on my license here, I couldn't prescribe the antibiotic. So I had to refer her to a nurse practitioner who could prescribe the antibiotic. My training as a naturopathic doctor is just as extensive, in my opinion, as the training a nurse practitioner receives to prescribe those drugs. But the restrictions on my license prohibit me from doing that, necessitating treatment delays, additional cost, and the potential that some patients might not follow through with a referral. It's inconvenient, it may be in a different office, it requires scheduling an appointment, maybe it's another insurance copay, and as a result, some patients, in my experience, don't ever follow through with that recommendation for a needed medication. As we know, Alaska has a shortage of primary care providers, and naturopathic doctors can fill that gap. We're safe primary care providers. We're trained to understand our scope of practice and to refer patients to other providers when it's necessary. I just saw a patient this week, very complex young gentleman with multiple issues, multiple surgeries, multiple medications being managed by other providers, and I wasn't touching any of those. But he's got symptoms that make me think he's got ulcerative colitis. I referred him to a gastroenterologist for a workup to determine if he's got ulcerative colitis, which could actually be a huge impact on his life going forward if it's not managed appropriately. And if he does have ulcerative colitis, we may try some things from a natural standpoint to manage that. And he may need to be on medications for that as well. I want my patients to have the best care and to have a positive outcome, regardless of what category the therapies are that that need to be employed. There are several things that really speak to the safety of naturopathic physicians practicing with a broad scope of practice that includes limited prescriptive authority. The two most telling are the rate of disciplinary actions and the document that was referenced that's in your packet from the Federation of Naturopathic Medicine Regulatory Authorities, I think is very illustrative of that, looking at the rates of disciplinary action in all of the states that regulate naturopathic physicians. That organization, by the way, the Federation, is made up of the regulators from the various state agencies. This is not a naturopathic group. This is the state regulators reporting in their statistics. The rate of of disciplinary action compared to MDs and DOs is about one tenth of what you see in for the MDs and about half of what you see for DOs. The other thing to look at is malpractice insurance. The rate of malpractice claims against naturopathic doctors nationwide is incredibly low, 0.0001%. And that's reflected in the malpractice insurance premiums that we're required to pay to insurance companies, which are incredibly low based on their experience with low malpractice claims being filed. Again, one of the additional responsibilities for naturopathic doctors that shows up in SB 44 is the requirement to report all malpractice actions to the department. That currently is not in our current statute. To the best of our knowledge, there have been no recent malpractice cases in the state of Alaska, but that this bill would close one of those loopholes. The formal education and training of naturopathic doctors really supports independent prescribing rights. It's comparable to that of nurse practitioners who already have this authority in Alaska and have had it for some time. Because this bill is a comprehensive rewrite, modernizing the language, as I mentioned, it does include some additional responsibilities that naturopathic doctors would have under the new statute. And as a profession, I can tell you we absolutely welcome that, welcome the additional oversight and regulation. We believe it's appropriate and are happy to support that. SB 44 would permit qualified naturopathic doctors to practice as trained and ensure that the safety of the citizens of Alaska, and I respectfully would request your support and passage of the bill. Thank you very much. I'll stop at this point, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much, Dr. Birdsall. Senator Bishop.
Thank you. Question. Does any of the naturopaths have the ability to do CDL, commercial driver's license, physicals, FAA flight exams?
That is a fascinating question.
And the reason, and let me give you, the reason I ask that is my doctor decided he wanted to go to Saipan, right? And so I couldn't find a doctor. I had trouble finding somebody to do that in Fairbanks, right? And we're wanting to expand your scope here a little bit. That's the question.
Through the chair to Senator Bishop, I do not know the answer to your question. We'll find that out. I don't believe currently, under the current statute, that any naturopathic doctors in the state do. I'm not aware that this bill would necessarily address that. But I'll investigate that and we'll get back to you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next up on Teams, we have Dr. Carrie Baldwin-Sayer. Dr. Baldwin-Sayer, please state your name and your location and begin your presentation. Welcome to Senate Labor and Commerce.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Senator Bjorkman and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Carrie Baldwin-Sayer. Just want to make sure everyone can hear me before I continue.
We can, ma'am.
Thank you. I'm a licensed naturopathic physician currently holding the position of Associate Vice President of Advancement at the National University of Natural Medicine, or NUNM, in Portland, Oregon. I was previously the Associate Dean of Clinical Education at NUNM and the President of the Oregon Association of Naturopathic Physicians. NUNM was established in 1956 and has the oldest accredited naturopathic medical program in North America. My testimony today is specifically intended to provide information about the education and training completed by naturopathic physicians and how that training is overseen and regulated by national accreditation organizations. And apologies in advance that some of my testimony is going to be slightly redundant with Dr. Birdsall. First, licensed naturopathic physicians all attend accredited naturopathic medical schools. Our institution has both a programmatic accreditor and a regional institutional accreditor. Both are overseen by the U.S. Department of Education. Our programmatic accreditor, the Council on Naturopathic Medical Education, sets the standards for the naturopathic program to ensure our graduates are well-trained to provide excellent and safe patient care. Our university is also overseen by a regional accreditor, NWCCU, the same accreditor to oversee our state's allopathic medical school, the Oregon Health Sciences University, and the University of Alaska. Both processes are rigorous, and I'm proud to report that we meet the same high standards as those prestigious institutions. Naturopathic medical programs are four-year graduate training programs. NUNM's program includes 5,047 hours of total education, including 1,254 hours of direct student involvement in clinical care. Admissions requirements include a bachelor's degree in a pre-medical area from an accredited college, as well as prerequisites that are nearly identical to the prerequisites for MD and DO programs in the U.S. The 1,254 clinical training hours are comparable to the education requirements for many other medical programs and exceed the 1,000 hours required in the two-year family nurse practitioner program at OHSU, for example. It is important to note that with less clinical training than naturopathic physicians, nurse practitioners have fully autonomous prescription authority, including controlled substances, and have no postgraduate residency requirements, while playing a vital role in the Alaskan healthcare system. To break down the MD education a bit more, the first 2 years consist of biomedical sciences and diagnostic training, including courses in anatomy, physiology, biochemistry, histology, pathology, microbiology, etc. And this foundation in human sciences is followed by an extensive study in diagnostic methods and procedures. This includes courses in physical examination, laboratory diagnosis, and diagnostic imaging. The second 2 years of the program are focused on translating that basic science knowledge into clinical application. The courses provide a framework for developing graduates into primary care physicians and include cardiology, gastroenterology, gynecology, endocrinology, and many other subjects. Concurrently, students take courses on disease management and prevention, using therapeutic modalities such as nutrition, lifestyle medicine, botanical medicine, pharmaceutical prescribing, minor surgical procedures, and more. I want to emphasize it is during this second two-year block of time that students receive specific instruction in pharmaceutical prescribing throughout 15 different courses, in addition to the prescribing they're doing in a primary care clinical setting during their internship. They receive extensive didactic and hands-on clinical training during these final 2 years in dermatologic and minor surgical procedures, including suturing techniques, biopsies, cryotherapy, and laceration repair. The students receive hands-on clinical training in a variety of settings throughout their program with gradually increasing levels of responsibility in patient care. They must pass 3 hands-on clinical examinations in order to graduate. The final exam occurring after a full year with their own supervised patient load in a state-credentialed primary care medical home that serves mostly Medicaid patients with complex medical needs. And finally, to be eligible for licensure, all NDs must pass 2 national board examinations. So in summary, I want to highlight that the educational program of naturopathic medical colleges does prepare our graduates to be competent, safe, effective healthcare providers who are able to assess the primary care needs of their patients. I would also like to point out that allowing NDs to have non-scheduled medication prescriptive authority and the ability to perform minor office procedures is a very low-risk addition to their existing scope of practice and is well within the confines of their training. Thank you so much for your time. I very much appreciate being here, and I welcome any questions you might have at this time.
Thank you very much. Any questions from committee members? Seeing none, we'll move on to Dr. Clyde Jensen. Dr. Jensen, welcome to Senate Labor and Commerce. Please state your name and location for the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Chairman Bjorkman. My name is Clyde Jensen. I have a PhD in pharmacology, and I am speaking to you today from St. George, Utah. Could you just acknowledge that you're able to hear me okay?
Yes, sir, we are.
Thank you very much. I have had the privilege as a pharmacologist to teach pharmacology to MD medical students, DO medical students, that is osteopathic medical students, and naturopathic medical students. I've also taught pharmacology to physician assistant students, to nursing students, and to other students of various healthcare professions. I've come to speak to you today because I am able to make comparisons among the various professions of the pharmacology that is taught in those professions. You'll be interested to know that I am currently a professor of pharmacology at an osteopathic medical school with campuses in Colorado, Utah, and Montana. The principal testimony that I would like to share is that when I have taught pharmacology and when I have designed pharmacology courses for naturopathic medical students, I've been careful to teach and design those courses in such a way that the number of pharmacology contact hours is virtually identical to those that are taught in MD and DO schools, and that the content of those contact hours is also virtually identical to that which is taught in MD and DO schools. I've been careful to do that for three reasons. One, I want to be certain that our naturopathic physician graduates are prepared to prescribe in those jurisdictions in which a pharmaceutical prescription authority falls within their scope of practice. A second reason that I want them to have the same pharmacology as their MD and DO colleagues is so that they will be able to collaborate with their MD and DO colleagues in caring for the patients that inevitably will see both MD, DO, and naturopathic physicians. A third reason that I've always felt it's important to teach pharmacology to naturopathic students at the same level as we do to MD and DO students is to prepare them to avoid the drug, herb, or drug nutrient interactions that can sometimes occur in practices. I don't wish to prolong my testimony further, except to say that I occasionally will testify at hearings of this type, not so much because I'm trying to promote the passage of a bill that will expand scope of practice, but that I believe that inasmuch as students and taxpayers are paying for the education of naturopathic and other healthcare professionals, those professionals need to be able to practice the things that they have been taught in medical school and that they're capable of performing. My concluding testimony to you would be that a naturopathic physician has been taught the pharmacology that would enable them to prescribe, to collaborate with other healthcare professionals, including MDs and DOs, and to avoid the drug interactions that may sometimes occur with the substances that are uniquely used by naturopathic physicians. Thank you again for allowing me to speak to you, and I'll be happy to answer any questions this time or later.
Thank you very much, Dr. Jensen. Are there any questions from committee members? Seeing none, we'll move on to Dr. Rob Downey joining us via the Teams Hub. Mr. Downey, please state your name and location for the record and begin your testimony.
Hello, everyone. I'm Rob Downey. I'm in Homer at Seaworthy Functional Medicine at Department of South Peninsula Hospital. Is my audio clear?
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Senator Bjorkman. I am dual trained and certified as both a board certified family practice MD for 23 years and an Institute for Functional Medicine certified practitioner with 18 years of functional medicine clinical practice. The training I received from the Institute is similar to the approach taught at naturopathic universities and is recognized by the American Association of Continuing Medical Education. I believe my dual training and decades of practice in Montana and Alaska have prepared me to speak to you today as a strong advocate for Senate Bill 44. In 2006, I met Hillary Daly, a naturopathic doctor trained at Bastyr University, who was treating a patient with autoimmunity difficulties not responding well to conventional medicine. This patient, who was disabled with psoriatic arthritis, eventually responded spectacularly to naturopathic treatment. I asked Dr. Daly.
Dr. Downey, we lost your audio.
Lost audio?
There you are.
Should I backtrack briefly, Senator?
We just lost you for like a second.
Okay. In 2006, I met Hillary Daly, a naturopathic doctor trained at Bastyr University, who was treating a patient with autoimmunity difficulties not responding well to conventional medicine. This patient, who was disabled with psoriatic arthritis, eventually responded spectacularly to naturopathic treatment. I asked Dr. Daly how I could have similar results with my patients. She encouraged me to go and be trained by the Institute for Functional Medicine. Following my additional training, Dr. Daly and I worked together in Alaska at Seldovia Village Tribe Health and Wellness, where I was the medical director from 2012 to 2014. During that period, I met naturopathic Dr. Abby Lang, who I share patients with to the present day. Dr. Daly and Dr. Lang have not only won my respect, but they're my clinical heroes. Both solve challenging cases which are beyond even the knowledge I've accumulated as a dual-trained provider. I believe naturopathic doctors are well-trained and perfectly suited to assist with the provision of much-needed primary care here in Alaska. Naturopaths I work with are very well-trained in the use of pharmacologic agents. It is not a surprise to me that there is testimony from Professor Jensen that his curriculum and instructional content to MDs and DOs is the same for naturopaths. Having worked extensively with naturopathic doctors, making decisions with them in shared collaborative settings, I know that reservations regarding these doctors being allowed to perform the scope of practice outlined in the legislation are unfounded. I am not aware of any factual evidence being provided to support the claim of harm. In fact, we can look to states where naturopaths have practiced under the same or similar scope of practice requested in SB 44 for decades to see they provide quality care with an exceedingly low number of allegations of patient harm. In my practice, I work closely with many Alaska licensed nurse practitioners. They do a wonderful job of prescribing for Alaskans and have done so for many years. Naturopathic physicians have postgraduate training equal to or beyond conventional nurse practitioner training. To say it's a dark irony, naturopathic physicians aren't prescribing in Alaska already is, from my perspective, an understatement. Although naturopaths tend to use medications as a last resort, they are very well trained to know what a medication is necessary. They know when blood pressure requires immediate care, pneumonia requires antibiotics, autoimmune flare-ups require prednisone, etc. Yet under the current restrictions, patient must get an appointment with a second medical provider, go to an ER to get required medication. Even a short lag between the initial diagnosis and eventual treatment often has dire consequences. Current system sometimes causes a lag of many days. Proposals that NDs be required to have someone else prescribe add links in the chain of treatment. The more links, the more delay, more points for the chain to break. Who suffers in this scenario? Our friends, neighbors, family, and loved ones. Once an immediate medical crisis has abated, naturopathic doctors are trained to work with patients to determine if lifestyle changes can mitigate an underlying health problem and if ongoing medication is necessary. This clinical judgment and care is no different from what a good MD or nurse practitioner would provide. Few among us would allow nonsensical restrictions on our boat mechanic or tax accountant, have someone else added right at the end of their work process, e.g. some additional person to authorize a new carburetor or diesel rebuild, some additional person to certify the legitimacy of accurate taxes. It's obvious in these scenarios, someone won't get their fish in or submit their taxes on time. I recommend we be commonsensical about ND prescribing in the same way. Alaska's primary care shortage has a negative impact on access to affordable care in the state. A naturopath who has graduated from a certified four-year medical program, passed required post-graduation exams, and passed the new test required by SB 44, measuring their pharmaceutical knowledge, should be able to prescribe medications as the bill would allow. We know it's time for all hands on deck. If we want to get serious about addressing our primary care shortage, we need to get these excellent naturopathic doctors the prescribing privileges they've trained for. Thank you. I'm available to answer questions you may have.
Thank you, Dr. Downey. Are there questions from members of the committee? Seeing and hearing none, Dr. Downey, thank you for being with us here today. Up next on the Teams Hub, we have Christine Sagan.
Hi, this is Christine. Can you hear me?
We can, ma'am. Please state your name and location for the record. Welcome to Senate Labor and Commerce.
Hi, this is Christine Sagan. May I talk?
You may.
Awesome. I'm a family nurse practitioner and owner of Vitae Integrative Medical Center in Anchorage, Alaska. Our clinic serves 5,700 patients all over the state of Alaska, and last year we provided over 8,000 visits to our community. We have a huge demand for care, especially for primary care, with over 15 new patient requests a week to establish as a primary care provider. Our naturopathic doctor has openings to see patients, but our inability to prescribe medication precludes patients from establishing care. This delays access for needed care in family medicine in our town. The demand for primary care is significantly higher post-COVID. Nurse practitioners and naturopaths are filling this role. Access to healthcare is an urgent issue in our state, especially with some of the retirements of healthcare providers during the COVID-19 pandemic. People can wait up to a year in this town to get a visit, and some clinics are not accommodating any new patients at all. Primary care providers see an average of 2,100 visits annually, which means the NDs in the state could provide a potential 100,000 visits to our people in the state of Alaska. I've been in practice for 17 years and have always practiced alongside with a naturopathic colleague. In fact, my first mentor was a naturopath, and as a result of my interactions with the naturopath, I can speak firsthand to their competency and training. This includes competency and knowledge of pharmaceutical medications as a component of their medical practice. In fact, I often consult with my colleagues to discuss patient cases for their expertise. Throughout the years, I've gone to many conferences and to include naturopathic continuing medication education courses, all of which have pharmacology updates. I've learned a lot and be able to apply that to my medical practice. In my medical practice, it's common for a naturopathic colleague to request that I see one of their patients for the purpose of prescribing medication. In this case, I must duplicate the patient exam just to prescribe the same medication my colleague would have if they're permitted to practice at the level of their training. This can be as simple as an antibiotic for a child's ear infection or an antifungal for a woman's yeast infection. Instead, patients are forced to see multiple providers, which is not in the patient's best interest. It wastes resources, finances, and time. 40 years ago, the nurse practitioners in Alaska faced the same challenge in updating their scope of practice to include prescriptive authority. They faced significant opposition from the Alaska State Medical Association, who alleged that nurse practitioners' education was inadequate. A prime component of their opposition was the NP training did not include a postgraduate residency. Despite the fact the legislature did authorize nurse practitioners to prescribe and perform minor office procedures, exercising these rights has allowed the nurse practitioners to serve a vital role in Alaska's healthcare system, which is done safely despite opposition from the ASMA. In fact, nurse practitioners provide over 1 million patient care visits per year in the state. Naturopathic doctors are in the same situation. However, we just heard testimony regarding the accreditation of naturopathic programs, the scope of biomedical sciences and diagnostic training, instruction and minor office procedures, and extensive direct clinical training. You've heard for a PhD in pharmacology that pharmacological instruction is the same whether teaching MDs, DOs, or naturopaths. Yet just because the NDs are not required to do post-graduation residency, the ASMA alleges they're unqualified to practice primary care up to the level of their training. Like naturopathic doctors, nurse practitioners are not required to complete a residency. Both are effectively trained to serve as primary care providers during the extent of their program. We We now operate a system where naturopathy doctors with a four-year doctorate degree must turn to the nurse practitioner to complete a component of a particular patient's care. The situation defies logic. I urge you to support Senate Bill 44 and to vote for the scope of expansion for naturopaths, allowing prescriptive authority as outlined in the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. Are there any questions for Ms. Sagan? Seeing none, next up we have Dr. Natalie Wiggins. Ms. Wiggins, if you could please state your name and location and begin your testimony. Welcome to Senate Labor and Commerce.
Good afternoon, Chairman Bjorkman and members of the committee. Thank you for dedicating your time to hear Senate Bill 44 today. My name is Dr. Natalie Wiggins. I'm a naturopathic doctor based in Anchorage, practicing at Vitae Integrative Medical Center. Here today in support of Senate Bill 44, and I hope that the information you've heard and will continue to hear will provide each of you with adequate information to give you the confidence to also support the bill, as it is in the best interest of Alaskan residents, particularly as we grapple with the nation's highest cost of medical care. The proposed scope outlined in Senate Bill 44 mirrors that which has been safely practiced in many other states for an extended period. Personally, I practiced medicine many years in Arizona, where I had a scope of practice that did reflect my level of training, knowledge, and competency. This included prescriptive authority and the ability to perform superficial wound repairs and biopsies. Our federal acquired through completion of my program and entrusted me with a DEA number, allowing me to prescribe scheduled 2N to 5 medications, as well as non-controlled medications. Despite my qualifications, the imposed limitations in Alaska forced me to refer my patients to medication management. While in Arizona, I engaged in clinical instruction and supervision of third and fourth year medical students. Clinical settings, such as the ones I led, allow students to gain proficiency in utilizing pharmaceutical medications in addition to other modalities. Additionally, while in Arizona, I worked with an MD in private practice who acknowledged me as an equal in prescriptive management for our patients. Returning to Alaska from Arizona was a choice fueled by my love for this state and my desire to raise my children here. However, this move meant giving up the ability to practice medicine to the extent of my training, which is a disservice both to myself and the Alaska residents that I serve. My training didn't change, my knowledge didn't change, and my ability to safely utilize prescriptive medications didn't change. Only my residents changed. I'm entrusted to perform all other aspects of primary care medicine here. I evaluate and diagnose my patients. I order and interpret their labs and imaging, perform necessary exams, and formulate a course of treatment. That treatment may require a pharmaceutical medication. Knowing that I was going to be participating today, I sort of took more look at where I would have prescribed in the past week of my practice. And what came up for me was I had a patient with a case of SIBO, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, and in her case of the presentation, she needed to have a course of Xifaxan and metronidazole. I had a patient with their first primary outbreak of herpes simplex virus. This could have easily been mitigated with a course of valacyclovir at presentation. I had a patient with acute nausea that was not responding to the normal intervention that I used with naturopathic medicine, and she could have done very well with Zofran. I won't bore you with more details, but these are some examples that I'm seeing on a very routine basis where patients are unable to get the extent of their care with me, and I have to refer them to another provider despite my ability to manage these medications. Drawing from my experience in Arizona, it's evident that this expanded scope is not only safe, but essential for comprehensive patient care. I appreciate your time, and I'll be available for questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Wiggins. Are there any questions for Dr. Wiggins? I have a question. Dr. Wiggins, I'm reading on page 6 of the bill about the practice of naturopathy, and it kind of describes the scope of everything that naturopathic physicians would be able to do, including minor surgery. Could you give me some idea about what those types of minor surgeries might be?
Sure. And I apologize. I don't know who asked the question.
This is Senator Bjorkman, ma'am.
Thank you, Senator Bjorkman. So minor office procedures would be like, you know, the clinic that I was operating in Arizona was to serve kind of an underserved population in the area. And I recall one time where a kid had had something fall on his head, and he had a laceration on his forehead, and so he needed stitches. So that would be an example of a minor office procedure. It's laceration repairs like that. It's superficial wound repairs, and then it's, you know, removing superficial lesions.
Okay. I've heard of some reports where naturopaths may be doing liposuction in Arizona. Is that something that you're familiar with?
I can't hear of that report. Yes, that is not something that I would consider to be a superficial minor office procedure. So I think that individual may have received additional training towards that. I don't know all of the ins and outs of that particular case. But liposuction is not something that we are trained routinely to do. And so it would not be included in this.
Very good. Thank you. Further questions? Thank you, Dr. Wiggins. Are there any other questions for the bill sponsor? Is there any committee discussion? Seeing none, we will set Senate Bill 44 aside for further consideration and take a brief at ease while we set up for the next bill. Thank you. We're back on the record at 2:33 p.m. here in Belts, Room 105 of the Thomas Stewart Building. Up next, we have Senate Bill 225, Occupational Licensing Fees. With us to make a brief presentation of the bill, we have Commissioner of the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. We do not have Commissioner Sandy with us today, but instead we have the Director of the Corporation for Professional Business Licenses, Sylvan Robb. Director Robb, please put yourself on the record. Welcome to Senate Labor and Commerce.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Sylvan Robb, the Director of the Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing at the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development. I am here today to talk to you about Senate Bill 225, Occupational Licensing Fees, which is a bill we are very excited about on behalf of our applicants and licensees. So SB 225 removes investigation costs from the regulatory costs that must be covered with professional licensing fees. So this is a fund source shift that's being proposed from the current fund source, which is 1155 Receipt Supported Services. So one DGF fund source to another, which would be Fund 10005, and that is additional receipts from our corporation's fees. So currently we collect more from corporate filings than requires to run that program. This would allow the division to continue to be self-sufficient, and we do not need to increase corporate fees in order to do this. The division already lapses funds to the general fund from those corporate and business licensing fees. Absolutely, Senator.
Sorry to interrupt.
I believe there's another bill in the hopper, Senate Bill 203, to increase fees. What are those fees and where do they go?
Thank you for the question, Mr. Chair. So that is also a bill introduced by the Governor, Senate Bill 203, that returns business license fees to the level they were at in 2008. In 2009, they were reduced from $100 to $50 for a business license, and that bill proposes to return that fee to what it was in 2008, which was $100.
And what account do those fees go into?
Those collections come in as 10005, so they're DGF collections, but the funds that are excess beyond what it costs us to run the program do flow to the general fund.
Roger.
And so those are the funds that I'm speaking about, Mr. Chair. So collectively between corporations and business licensing, in a typical year, the division lapses over $8 million to the general fund. And so we are proposing to use some of those fees to help pay for investigations for professional licenses. So you can see here on the screen the current language related to how we must calculate professional license fees. The important parts are bolded, and so you'll see that that calculation requires that we include the cost of investigations, and that includes the cost of all of our certified investigators as well as legal costs for the Department of Law, hearing costs at the Office of Administrative Hearings, as well as Superior or even the Supreme Court in some cases. This means that in years where we have a high number of complaints for a particular profession or an extremely complex case, that will impact licensing fees for those professions. And so that is some of what we're proposing to mitigate with this bill.
Senator Gray Jackson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I may be asking the question too soon, but and correct me if I'm wrong, but are you saying, because you have so much money, you said $8 million at the end of the year that you have, that that lapse money will cover these fees that you're not going to be charging folks?
Through the chair, Senator Gray Jackson. So currently, professional licensing fees in statute, and that was the, as you can see here on slide three, we are required to set professional licensing fees to cover the cost of regulating that program. And currently, those costs include professional licensing fees. So the funds that the division lapses to the general fund are from dues paid for business license fees as well as corporate filing fees.
May I follow up?
Yes.
Thank you. So the bill removes investigation, legal, and hearing costs. Okay. So I guess that I'm not talking about the license fees. I'm talking about these costs and the money that lapses. Will that cover these costs?
Through the chair, Senator Gray Jackson, yes. And it does not take all of the costs that we currently lapse to the general fund. So as I mentioned, that's about $8.3 million in a typical year that gets lapsed. These costs for investigations are $4.7 million So the division would continue to lapse funds, just a smaller amount.
One more follow-up question, if I may. Thank you. So what happens, this bill is approved, and these costs are covered by money that lapses. What happens when you don't have as much money that lapses to cover these costs? What happens then?
Through the chair, Senator Gray-Jackson, at that point, we would need to seek an additional source of funding to cover this. Right now, we would still have several million dollars in excess of what we need. We have seen both corporate filings and the number of business licenses purchased continue to increase over the years, and so we would expect to see that revenue source grow through the years.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Please continue, Director.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So here on slide four, you can see our primary reasons for proposing this bill. So as I mentioned earlier, in our fee setting equation for professional licensing fees, investigations are the most volatile element of that equation. Because again, we can't know what investigations there may be in a particular year, how complex those may be, the length to which those may go in the court system. And so it can make it really challenging for professional licensees to anticipate those. And I have a couple examples on the next slide of some cases where we've seen large swings in licensing fees as a result of investigations. Another benefit that we would see from this is that this would reduce licensing fees. Again, currently licensing fees are based on the cost to run the program. If we remove the element of investigations from that equation, that will decrease licensing fees. It won't be the same across the board because it will depend on how many investigations a particular profession has seen as well as how complex those are. But no program will be negatively impacted by this. The reduction in fees may really help us recruit, especially in a number of professions where we have shortages in Alaska, and we hear anecdotally from licensees that Alaska has some of the highest professional licensing fees in the nation. So just a couple examples. We know veterinarians, our fees are very much on the high side nationally, as well as for nurses.
Senator Dunbar has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this relates to the question that the chair asked earlier about SB 203. And I think when I first saw the two bills, I thought that they were impacting the same kind of fees. But now I'm realizing they actually might be different. Correct me if I'm wrong, because what you're talking about in 203, which I realize isn't before us, but it's going to impact your budget in a different way. You're going from $50 to $100 in some cases, but those are flat fees. Is that correct? Whereas these, you're saying, are variable fees. So how does that work? You have the flat fee, and then you have additional variable fees for these professions? Or how do you calculate these fees?
Thank you for the question, Senator Dunbar, through the chair. As the name of the division, we do corporations, business licensing, and professional licensing. Corporation fees are set in regulation. There are 64 different corporate fees, depending on what kind of filing and the type of corporation. That's, again, not impacted by this, but we are proposing to use some of those fees to offset the cost of investigations for professional licensing. HB 203 relates to business licensing, and those fees are set in statute, which is why we will be talking about HB 203 with you next week. And so because those are set in statute, we would obviously need 203 in order to make a change. And so these are the fees for professional licensing. And so these are the 45 programs that we've talked to you about. This is licensing for doctors, dentists, naturopaths, midwives, as well as construction contractors. And those fees are required to cover the cost of regulating that program. And so we are proposing to extract the investigations from the calculation of the cost of regulating the program.
Thank you, follow up, Mr. Chair. This is sort of jumping to the end of the presentation, but I think it might cut to the concerns that some of us have with this. Because obviously, if you're transferring less money into the general fund, then essentially it's a rather large fiscal note for the state as a whole, right? If you were to do this, but your other bill raises more money, and so I guess my question is: is there a way to pull out these? This is causing a lot of volatility. is there a way to pull this out and stabilize it, but stabilize it at a slightly higher number so that whatever the cost of this ends up being, the net of this, is roughly equivalent to the net from raised in the other bill? You see what I'm saying? Is there a way to structure these so we could do that?
Through the chair to Senator Dunbar, I do follow your question, sir, and I think certainly we could maybe parse out the cost of investigations more so that we were this bill was only proposing to cover a portion of investigative costs, or certainly the legislature, if it wanted, could say, we'll allow the division to take, X amount of money from corporation fees to offset investigations, but those costs that remain will still be part of the fee setting equation. So there are a number of different ways that you could achieve what you're suggesting.
I guess one last follow-up, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm, and this is a bit, perhaps this will get hammered out at the finance table, but I'm thinking less that we cross-subsidize corporate to licensing fees, and rather just sort of recognize that we're going to reduce a lot of the volatility, but we might then set these fees a little higher than they would be with all those investigation costs pulled out. Does that make sense? So you drop the number, but you drop it to a slightly higher number so that the net fiscal position of the state isn't as harmed. Does that make sense?
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, I certainly understand what you're suggesting. Part of the argument we would have for this bill is that we really feel that investigations into professional licensees and into unlicensed practice is a public safety issue.
Right.
And the way that the funding is currently structured, that onus to pay for that falls on licensees, those people who are following the rules, those people who've gotten a license, those people who are behaving as they should end up paying for the folks who don't. And the point of having professional licenses is that if people don't know what they're doing and don't follow the rules, people can be harmed. And so we do see a real public safety element to investigations.
Yes, I agree with that. But also it is these professions, although it's only certain people in the professions, you're right, but it's these professions, bad actors in these professions, that are sort of imposing those costs on the state, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Anyway, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the questions. And then finally, we already sort of touched on the fact that we have, the people who are following the rules who are paying for the bad apples. But lastly, and we don't have firm evidence of this because certainly people aren't coming to report to us, but for those individuals who do understand the way fees are set and that investigations are part of the expense that they bear, it could provide a disincentive for someone to report on a fellow member of their profession that they need to be investigated. And so this would remove that potential disincentive. So here are a few examples, as I mentioned, of where we've seen substantial fee increases over a very short amount of time. So midwives is probably the most glaring. Their fees went from $1,250. The next renewal was at $1,450. And then after that, $1,750. And then the following up to $3,800. Obviously, if you're a business person and you're planning for your expenses, expecting a less than $2,000 licensing fee, and then when you submit your renewal, you find out that instead you owe nearly $4,000. That's very challenging for people. I am happy to report that midwives' licensing fees have since come down some. They're down to $2,800. Another example that a lot of people may be familiar with, you may remember when Alaska made the national news in 2020, there was a dentist who was filmed conducting a dental procedure while standing on a hoverboard. That case continues before the Alaska Supreme Court, and that is again something where all the other dentists in Alaska are picking up the cost of that investigation and that ongoing court costs. So those are just a few examples of what we're talking about when we're looking at these investigative fees and how they impact other licensees. We have just a few slides that share some information from our investigative annual report, we just want to give you some sense of what we're talking about. In a typical year, we see between 1,200 and 1,500 to 1,600 investigations conducted by the division. Here on slide 7, you can see the top complaints received by the division, and it's worth noting that, you know, the second most common complaint is people operating without a license. And so, again, in order to investigate and take action against those individuals, those costs are currently being borne by the individuals who did choose to get a license and follow state law. Here on slide...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Rob, do you touch every licensed business once a year or twice a year? Or once every 2 years? Or
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, all of our licenses are good for 2 years, and they are good. All of the licenses for a particular profession expire on the same day. So depending on when you purchase your license, you'll still hit the renewal period at the same time.
So follow up?
Yes.
Thank you. Investigating them and like the continuing education violation, how do you find that?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop. So in order to renew for all of those professions that require continuing education, individuals attest on their application that they have met the continuing education requirement. The division then selects a sample of individuals that are audited, and then we reach out to those individuals and require them to submit proof that they did indeed obtain their continuing education.
Senator,
thank you. So follow up.
Yes.
So you're not going out and checking every business. You're doing a random sample.
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, that is correct.
Thank you.
Have 109,000 professional licenses. We would need a lot more people.
Right. That's my point. I'm just trying to put on the record that it's like OSHA. I mean, OSHA, you know, there's so many businesses. You can only investigate one business, and that investigator's working lifetime, right? It's complaints that come in to the shop. I don't know if they come into your shop and you go do an investigation. Is that how it works in your shop?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, you are correct. The majority of our investigations are complaint-driven. We do have a number of professions for which we do conduct inspections, but for the most part, it is complaint-driven.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Welcome. Senator Gray Jackson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I don't appreciate the senator asking my question. I'm just kidding. That was he asked the exact same question that I had. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're welcome. Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is not within the scope of this bill, but something you said is very interesting, that every person in a given profession is renewed on one particular day for a two-year period. Has there ever been this discussion about going to sort of a rolling process where you'd get licensed and then that would be good for 2 years? I mean, there's a lot of other processes where we do that. Is it prorated? I mean, I'm thinking about 32,000 licensed nurses, and they all have to – their licenses all start on the same day. Mm-hmm. It seems like that would cause a variety of challenges within their profession.
Through the chair to Senator Dunbar, I agree that's a perfectly reasonable thought from the outside. A lot of it is that because people are required to comply with the regulations, and regulations change you know, with some frequency as the boards are updating things and requirements change. If we did not have a firm date at which you are saying I complied, it would be a real administrative burden to try to track. You know, for nursing, we have 32,000 licensees.
Right.
To try to track 32,000 different expiration dates and ensure that we notified people in a timely fashion that they needed to renew, and then ensure that, you know, they were paying the correct fee when we update fees for the time when they were renewing versus when other people are renewing. It is actually less burdensome to the division to have people hit that point. And of course, for our 45 different licensing programs, those are spread throughout the course of that 2 years.
Sure.
So that we, you know, minimize the burden on the division all at once. So, you know, construction contractors are offset from nurses, from doctors, from pharmacy.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully we'll have the computer the technology at someday that can all, what you're describing, can all be automated, or most of it can. So we're trying, like, if the date is January 1st and someone becomes a nurse and gets licensed December 30th, that means they have to do the whole process again in 2 days, right? Or whatever the process would be, you know, 3 weeks or whatever.
Yeah, through the chair to Senator Dunbar, I am happy to report that renewals for all of our professional licenses can be completed online. It's not just automatic. So if you answer yes to a professional fitness question and indicate that you might have been convicted of a crime or had some, you know, medical or substance abuse problem that requires further examination before we renew your license, then there's processing time. But for people who, you know, got their continuing education, didn't have any issues, all of those are available online. Additionally, just to assure you, for people who do get their license within 3 months prior to the expiration date, they are grandfathered in and do not owe us a fee for that subsequent two-year period.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Let's continue.
So here on slide 8, we just wanted to show you some of the top our top 10 programs that receive complaints. The Board of Nursing, obviously not a surprise that they are the top complaint recipients, since they have 32,000 licensees. And then you can see on down those particular professions where we receive more complaints.
Senator Bishop has a question.
Director Rob, construction contractors, can you give me an example of a complaint?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, many of the issues that we experience with construction contractors are related to their maintenance of the required bond and insurance. And so that's a lot of what we're checking for during their renewal, is to ensure that they have those requirements. Otherwise, a lot of the complaints we receive for them are related to unlicensed practice. And then we get people who have complaints that are not jurisdictional for us, because people are, you know, they got an ugly deck, but that's not something that we can take action on.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So here on slide 9, you'll see the top professions. So again, previously it was the programs. This is by profession. Again, registered nurses, not at all a surprise given that there are 25,000 registered nurses for Alaska. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to go through the sectional if it's the will of the committee, or very good. Happy to answer any other questions the committee has.
Thank you, Madam Director. I'll make a statement, and I'd like you to comment on the correctness of the statement. Would it be possible to adjust statute to allow these licensing boards, the licensing that is kind of governed by boards, to maintain a larger fund balance in their board accounts to act as a shock absorber when they do have large spikes in investigation costs? It's my understanding through the sunset bills and audits that we've seen here in our committee that they're required to essentially draw their fund balance down to pretty much close to nothing if they have one. Would it be possible to allow them to have and maintain a larger fund balance so that they could level out their fees?
That's an excellent idea, Mr. Chair. We do have carry forward language for all of the professional licensing fees that we collect. We typically do try to maintain 1 year worth of expenses for the program so that we can basically provide that shock absorber that you are suggesting. Because we do try to keep fees from bouncing all over the place for licensees. So generally, you know, if a program has accrued quite a surplus, you know, when we're doing that fee analysis and looking at whether we should reduce fees, we tend to be sort of conservative on the number of people we think will renew their licenses or apply for new licenses, while being generous when we're looking at what we anticipate the cost might be. Because we do want to keep fees relatively stable for programs to the best of our ability. But the legislature has kindly granted us that carry forward authority already, so we do try to provide that smoothing effect on fees.
Very good. Thank you. Nothing further from me. Any other questions? I will take a brief at ease. Back on the record at 3 o'clock, we are here in Belcher Room 105 of the Thomas Stewart Building. We have set Senate Bill 225, Occupational Licensing Fees, aside for further consideration. And now we are taking up Senate Bill 237, Tax Credit Child Care Utility House Food. Today with us, we have Fidel Amani, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Revenue, and Michael Williams is joining us via the Teams Hub, Acting Deputy Director of the Tax Division, to present the bill. Deputy Commissioner, welcome to Senate Labor and Commerce. Please state your name for the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Fidel Amani, Deputy Commissioner for Department of Revenue. As you indicated online, we have our Acting Tax Director, Mike Williams, who's going to go through the sectional analysis and help address any questions. Before you for consideration, Mr. Chair, is SB 237, which is the Alaska Affordability Act, also known as the AAA bill. We're very excited about this legislation. It's one of the top priorities that the Gov has tasked the Department of Revenue to work on this session as it pertains to the livability aspect of it within the state. The Gov wants to develop the communities within the state and ensure that Alaskan families continue to call our great state their home and attract more people and families to our state. In doing so, this legislation focuses on four key areas, which is the child care, the housing, energy, and food security. The idea behind this legislation, Mr. Chair, is that it creates a tax incentive for corporations and businesses to offset their corporate income tax liability for those qualified expenditures in those four key areas. The idea is that the Department of Revenue will define the qualified expenditures through regulation, and also the proposed legislation is limited to 50% of the qualified expenditures and cannot exceed 50% of the corporate tax liability for any given 1 year. As the committee may know, the state does not have a broad base taxes, and so the corporate income tax is one of the few levers that we have available to incentivize businesses in being able to develop our communities and provide economic development. Looking at slide 3, what we wanted to show here is the FY23 general fund revenues associated with the corporate income tax. The total is approximately $436 million, of which 70% of that is tied to oil and gas for the year. Also, we have footnoted the $436 million that does not include the $7.6 million that gets deposited into the Constitutional Budget Reserve.
Senator Gray Jackson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for your presentation. Can you tell me why tourism is a negative?
Through the chair, Senator Jackson, that's attributed to the carryover from the CARES Act, but I will call on Acting Tax Director Mike Williams that he has more details about that one.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Through the chair to Senator Gray Jackson. My name is Michael Williams. I'm the acting deputy director for the tax division. Under the Federal CARES Act, enterprises that corporations that had net losses in the years of 2018, 2019, and 2020 were allowed under federal statute to carry back those losses up to 5 years and claim refunds. There was a process for filing those claims, and just due to the timing of filing claims and paying out refunds, some of that refund process hit fiscal year 23, and that is where the roughly $18 million in negative revenue is attributed to those refund claims.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Looking at slide four, Mr. Chair, if I may, is the estimated revenue impact associated with this legislation. So at this time, we don't have clear visibility of what the revenue impacts, as we can't predict the taxpayer behavior. However, what we've done is been able to put an analysis together that looks at the maximum impact for any given 1 year, which would range from negative $238 million for fiscal year 25 to negative $267 million for fiscal year 30. And so what we've done in this chart here for all of those years is demonstrated the petroleum portion that would be impacted in the non-petroleum. And so looking at for fiscal year 25, you're looking at 87.5 for the non-petroleum, 150.1 for the petroleum, and then going through 2030, looking at 126.3 for the non-petroleum and to 140.5 for the petroleum revenue. Looking at the implementation costs, there are going to be some system programming that will need to take place within the tax revenue management system. However, these are things that we'll be able to do within the existing infrastructure and resources that we have within the tax division of the Department of Revenue. With that, Mr. Chair, if there's no other questions, I'd like to turn this to Mike Williams to go through the sectional analysis.
Mr. Williams.
Thank you, Chair Bjorkman. Again, for the record, my name is Michael Williams, Acting Deputy Tax Director for the Department of Revenue. To the Chairman and members of the committee, Section 1 adds a new provision in Alaska Statute 43.20, which will create a new tax credit, the Alaska Affordability Tax Credit. The amount of the credit is up to 50% of the corporation's tax liability. The credit is 50% of qualifying expenditures for employer-provided child care, residential heating, electricity affordability, housing affordability, and food affordability. The bill authorizes the department to adopt regulations that define qualifying expenditures. A contribution claimed as an Alaska affordability tax credit could not also be the basis for a different tax credit or be allowed as a federal tax deduction in computing the Alaska corporate income tax. The credit is non-transferable and cannot be carried forward or backward. The Section 2 of the bill would have the credit take effect January 1, 2025. And with that, that concludes the sectional analysis. If there are any questions.
Thank you very much, Acting Deputy Director. Senator Dunbar has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have to run to another committee here soon to get ready for another committee, but I assume we'll have more hearings on this given, you know, it's $200 million. So I think we've got a lot more to talk about. But I guess my two questions are, let's say a relatively large corporation decides to use this tax credit to set up a child care, a daycare for their employees. But then they also pay for the overhead costs, using presumably this tax credit, or they try to offset that. But then they also charge a fee to their employees. I mean, it's not going to be free for their employees. Let's say they, offer – basically it's a subsidized rate. But how would that work? How would that interact with the with the tax credit. You see what I'm saying? Like, would they be prohibited from still charging a rate? Are there any controls on that rate that they would charge to their employees? Could they find themselves actually making money off the daycare still, or making it revenue neutral?
I'll defer this to Mike Williams because he understands the mechanics behind the credits.
Mr. Williams.
Certainly, through the chair to Senator Dunbar, again, Mike Williams, acting deputy tax director. I understand the question. There's a lot of complexities involved there, some of which I can explain here. The rest would probably require some follow-up. The under Section 129 of the Internal Revenue Code, an employer can provide a certain level of daycare to an employee or on behalf of their employees without it being considered compensation to that employee. Likewise, an employee can make elective deferrals tax-free for childcare up to a certain amount. That's typically $5,000 of provided childcare for both employer or the employee. That said, anything that of value provided beyond that could then be considered a compensation to the employee. Or that if an employer is charging an employee for daycare, then the amount in the up to $5,000 could be excluded, but then the from income, but anything of value beyond that is taxable to the employee. Or that if the employee, but I don't, it certainly, there's no prohibition on how much an employer would charge an employee for the daycare other than market factor as to, you know, it certainly, I wouldn't envision that being a very good recruitment or retention benefit to charge the employees an excessive amount for child care.
So my follow-up to that, Mr. Chair, then. So if, you know, if the employer is free to continue charging for this daycare, you know, even taking advantage of the tax, how do you know 50% is the right number? So what you're trying to do essentially, I think, is tip them over into affordability. Tip it over to the point where it makes sense for the employer to set this up and it's reasonably affordable for the employee to use the service. How do you know that 50% is the right number, not 30% or 20%? Why let them write off 50% exactly?
Through the chair to Senator Dunbar, that's certainly a policy call. I don't have any input from commercial enterprises as to what level of incentive might get them to provide X level of daycare.
Through a chair.
That then just becomes a policy call on your part.
Thank you, Acting Director Williams. Mr. Lamani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Dunbar, in looking at the 50%, as we've seen across the state, child care has been a critical need, especially as we've been emerging out of the pandemic. We've had a lot of moms and parents that have been wanting to come back into the workforce, and they haven't had the opportunity to be able to do that because child care is extremely expensive. At the same time, it's not cost beneficial to them. So oftentimes they decide to stay home. That's why we've seen also reduction in the workforce in some areas. That being said, we wanted to create an incentive that was worthwhile for the corporations to be able to look at this, understanding that there's going to be a lot of administrative costs on the front end for them to be able to do that. And so by being able to do that, it ultimately helps on both ends from the state's perspective as well as on the private sector as well.
One last comment before I leave, Mr. Chair. I think I hear that and I understand that, but we're talking about $200-something million here. And for example, the governor vetoed $7.5 million out of Head Start last year, right? So that is functions like daycare for a lot of really low-income families. This we're talking about primarily the petro payers, for example, you know, middle class, upper middle class folks that absolutely need help with this. But I'm wondering, you know, if it wasn't $200 million, the fiscal note here, but instead $150 million, and we could still tip it over into affordability for a bunch of those companies. We'd have $50 million more dollars to do something like dramatically expand Head Start, for example. See, so that's sort of where I'm trying to do this cost benefit here. 50 without a lot more data here, 50% just seems like kind of an arbitrary number. And so I guess that's what I'm looking for is some more analysis from the department of why that number in particular. You know, is there a regression analysis that shows that other states that have done this, you know, we put in 40% or 50% and 60%, it gets you X number of additional, you know, childcare providers, for example. You know, how has it worked in other states that have tried this? That's the data I'm looking for.
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, appreciate that follow-up question. Looking at it from that perspective, even on the education component, where we have the contributions, a lot of the entities that do contribute, we don't hit the maximum contribution, the ceiling on that one. And so the idea here is that to make it worthwhile for corporations to be able to do that. So even at the 50% mark, we don't know to the what extent businesses would entertain the infrastructure that they would have to put in place to be able to look at something like that. And that's just only within the child care, let alone some of the other classifications as well, especially when you get into energy and housing. Those are much more complex, much more costly than the child care.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Deputy Commissioner, anything further?
Nothing on my end, Mr. Chair.
Any questions? Well, thank you very much for your presentation of this bill today.
Thank you.
We will set aside Senate Bill 237 on child care, utility, house, and food credits. And we will meet again on Monday, March 18th, when we'll hear two bills. First up that day will be Senate Bill 203, business licenses and fees, and Senate Bill 200, TRS contribution rate, PERS, Social Security, or SBS for local municipalities and school districts, where we will explore the cost to the potential cost to the mill rate and impacts that that bill would have on working folks. As there's no business to come before the committee, we are adjourned at 3:16 p.m.